This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Cyber Elaine. On today's program, can the competition watchdog stop petrol price gouging after the Saudi oil attacks? We check out pill testing at a UK music festival that could be a model for Australia.
Within an hour of putting out our alert about the yellow Superman pills, people were coming into the Loop service and they were disposing of those pills with us. Those pills that were handed in, that's the difference between people having a good time at the festival or having an absolutely terrible time in the medics.
But first, to the chaos and confusion in New South Wales politics this morning with an attempted leadership spill against the Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, being called off at the last minute. Rebel MPs were threatening to try and turf Ms Berejiklian from the job 6 months after her successful election. Three Conservative MPs announced last night they wanted the Premier gone over moves to decriminalise abortion in the state. Our reporter Thomas Arredi has been following the story and he joins me now. Good morning, Thomas. What concerns have these MPs raised about the abortion bill?
Hey, morning, Sabra. We received a joint statement from three MPs last night, Tanya Davies, Matthew Mason-Cox and Lou Amato. They've expressed concern that four key amendments to the bill had been rejected. Now, those amendments involve a prohibition on sex selection abortions, proper medical care for aborted babies born alive, protection of conscientious objection rights for doctors and allied health professionals, and the stricter regulation of late-term abortions. They also say they made it clear 3 weeks ago that those amendments needed to be included at an absolute minimum to ensure their continued membership of the Liberal Party room. But they also say the proper parliamentary process hasn't been followed with this bill. They're concerned it's been fast-tracked, and their request to establish a joint select committee into abortion law reform has been rejected, remembering here that in New South Wales, it's the last state to be looking at reforming its criminal codes on abortion. So we have a situation now where until a short time ago, Gladys Berejiklian was facing this test of her leadership just 6 months after she led the government to a third term victory.
So what's the latest? They were threatening a spill. It's not going to happen anymore.
That's right. A short time ago, we were still expecting to see this spill motion at the party room meeting this morning. We've now confirmed that the motion has been called off. Tanya Davies has just released a statement saying the group has received confirmation that further concessions will be forthcoming in relation to the bill. So they've decided to withdraw the motion. Now, it's important to note here, though, Sabra, that Gladys Berejiklian was expected to survive. The issue here, though, is whether what's happened will damage her authority and whether it'll damage the government's standing in the parliament. She only has a two-seat majority. So if these MPs move to the crossbench, that could have a real impact. But look, in the lead-up to this, the Premier's supporters told AM they weren't concerned. One of them is the New South Wales Families Minister, Gareth Ward.
Let me make it perfectly clear. Bring it on. Gladys Berejiklian is the reason why we won the last election, and she's going to be the reason why we win the next one. This is just absolute stupidity from a fringe in our party room that want to cause her grief over something that the majority of the community support.
That's New South Wales Families Minister Gareth Ward. And Thomas, have you been hearing from other Liberal MPs about this issue this morning?
Yeah, they've certainly been active on social media, Sabra, and in particular those members of Parliament considered to be future leadership contenders. The Treasurer, Dominic Perrottet, says Gladys Berejiklian is the people's choice and he supports her. Transport Minister Andrew Constance simply says, no, not running, with a hashtag of comical. On top of that, the Planning Minister, Rob Stokes, says the Premier has his full support. The state's Attorney General Mark Speakman said earlier the motion would be a fizzer. And the Deputy Premier, Nationals MP John Barilaro, called the move ridiculous and dumb. But we're also hearing from the Nationals at a federal level. The former Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce spoke at an anti-abortion rally in Sydney over the weekend, and he spoke to Sky News this morning.
This is the biggest issue probably in a political career. And it is like sticking your finger in a wasp's nest. It is so hard to get the wasp back in. Therefore, you have to give it an immense period to basically be discussed, to give everybody the respect they need to be heard. First of all, I respect Gladys immensely as the Premier, but this was never given the proper ventilation. They had a longer inquiry into Chooks than they did into what we believe is a person's life.
That's Federal National's backbencher Barnaby Joyce, and before him our reporter Thomas Aretti. The federal government is expected to unveil the details of its so-called Big Stick energy policy today at a party room meeting. The bill threatens forced breakups of power companies if they fail to pass on cost savings. The policy is part of the government's response to rising power prices. It partially re-regulated the sector in July, with the competition watchdog, the ACCC, saying that 800,000 customers have already seen their bills drop as a result. The ACCC chairman is Rod Sims. I spoke with him a short time ago. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Your report yesterday found that the three big electricity retailers, AGL, Energy Australia and Origin, have responded to the government changes by actually increasing the prices for its cheapest offers to consumers. How surprising is that?
They were signalling that they were going to do that, but keep in mind, as I say, the standing offers have come down a lot, saving those people who are on them a lot of money. What they've done to try and recoup the money is push up some of the prices of their lowest offers. But the key thing is essentially the players other than the big three have not done that. And so consumers can still get those lower prices. They may just need to move to one of the smaller retailers. I think that will have an effect on the big players. I think they'll struggle to maintain those higher prices in the face of competition.
Why are the big players behaving like that?
Because they were charging outrageous prices on the standing offers. They kept pushing up the standing offers to those who weren't on a market offer, so they could offer bigger and bigger discounts. But as they pushed up the base, the discount didn't give you much. But because the government has now, from July 1, brought those standing offers down, that means for the sort of 10% of households and or 15% of households and 20% of small businesses, they're no longer paying those outrageous prices, and that's revenue lost mainly to the big three companies.
The Minister Angus Taylor said yesterday that millions of customers had changed companies because of the changes. Is that right?
We're certainly seeing a drift to the smaller players. It's fairly early days to really understand it completely, but certainly there's been a bit of a shift, and there's two segments in the market.
I was going to say millions, though. Is that over-egging it a little?
I don't have those numbers to know how many. He may have numbers. We don't. We've just been looking at what's been going on since July. We have seen movement. I don't know how many have moved.
The so-called Big Stick legislation, will that lower prices? Are you confident that it will do that?
Oh, look, the main thing with the Big Stick legislation, which gets lost, is it's mainly focusing on companies having to pass through cost reductions in their retail prices, make sure the spot market behaviour in the generation market is appropriate, and make sure they're not denying contracts to smaller players. That, all else equal, you'd think would have an effect on lowering electricity prices. There's been a big debate about this bill. As far as I'm concerned, the debate is now over. The government's proceeding. They've made some changes. The ACCC's role will be to enforce those three new provisions as best we can, and we will certainly do that.
Many consumers want a big stick for petrol companies. They're worried that fuel companies will use the weekend Saudi oil attacks to lift prices. How closely will you be watching this?
Oh, we monitor petrol prices very closely. So far, as I understand it, the price has gone up by about $6 a barrel, which translates to about 6 cents a litre at the pump. We'll certainly be watching to see whether prices increase by more than what's happening internationally, to see whether people are taking advantage of that. So if that happens, we will most certainly let everybody know.
When is it reasonable for those prices to go up?
Oh, look, the price of petrol in Australia is set by the international oil price. There's no doubt about that. So when the international oil price goes up, then yes, we feel it at the bowser, and that has a profound effect on the entire Australian economy. So let's hope the effect on petrol prices internationally or oil prices internationally is not too large.
There's also a stoush now between the major airlines. Qantas and Virgin have joined up to challenge the airport monopoly over costs. Who's right?
We've been putting the view for some time at the ACCC that you've got airports which are effectively unregulated monopolies. We've been proposing for some time a negotiate arbitrate regime that would give the airlines, be they Qantas, Virgin, or the smaller ones, the ability to negotiate with the airports, and if they don't get the deal they want, the right to arbitration. If you like, it would even up the bargaining power. So this is something that has been an ACCC initiative, and we just think there needs to be some form of regulation when you have monopolies.
The airlines, the airports say that the airline companies are restricting seats, and they say that they're actually inflating costs. But some consumers also point out they're paying $1,000, for example, for a return flight from Cloncurry to Brisbane. Consumers seem to be the losers here, are they?
Look, consumers will lose if there's an unregulated monopoly. Consumers will lose if there's not enough competition, particularly on some of those regional routes. But one of the things to point out is that you've got a lot of regional airports where a lot of money is spent on them. Sometimes that's more money than needed to be spent on them. But, of course, that's just passed through to the consumer. So, again, it gets back to saying if you've got a monopoly, there's got to be some limits on your pricing power. That's something we've held for a long time. It applies to ports, and there's a push on now to deregulate some of the monopoly ports, which I think is very unfortunate. The same argument applies to airports.
ACCC Chairman Rod Sims, thanks for joining the program this morning.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to AM This Morning, where it's 11 minutes past 8. Saudi Arabia says it has evidence that Iran and not Yemeni rebels was behind the attack that's crippled its oil production and led to a spike in the crude oil price. Global consensus is building towards retaliation against Iran, but it's not clear whether the response will be a military or economic one. Here's Middle East correspondent Adam Harvey.
Satellite images of the damaged oil facilities in Saudi Arabia appear to show a precise, sophisticated attack. There are 17 different impact points. One photograph shows a row of four spherical processing tanks pierced in almost identical spots by separate projectiles. A Saudi military spokesman said that whatever did the damage came from the north, from the direction of Iran, and not from Yemen, which is 800 kilometres in the opposite direction. Initial evidence shows that these weapons are Iranian weapons, and we are investigating this and we will announce the findings. Initial findings show that the terrorist attack did not originate from Yemeni territories as claimed by the Houthi militia. At the United Nations, there was strong condemnation of the attacks that have caused oil prices to leap, increased the risk of a war that could engulf the Middle East, and effectively halted Saudi Arabia's ability to process crude oil for export. The US ambassador, Kelly Kraft, backed the Saudi assessment of blame.
There is no evidence that the attacks came from Yemen. Emerging information indicates that responsibility lies with Iran.
And the UK's representative suggested a multinational response.
At the moment, we're still assessing what happened and who is responsible for the attacks. Once this has been established, we will discuss with our partners how to proceed in a responsible manner. We hope for a united international response to these awful attacks.
Ali Vaez from the Crisis Group says it's easy to see how things could get worse from here.
But if direct military action is taken against the Iranians, then we have to expect another cycle of escalation.
Iran has denied responsibility, but the attacks seem to be beyond the means of Houthi rebels and may be aimed not at provoking war, but at demonstrating to the US that the cost of a conflict will be immense for all involved.
If one understands that this attack, proximate cause for this attack, is the fact that the US is strangulating the Iranian economy, one would come to the conclusion that it's the maximum pressure policy of the Trump administration that is starting to backfire. And the way out of it is not to do more of the same, but to find a way of de-escalating tensions.
This is Adam Harvey in Beirut for AM.
Taiwan says it's immediately terminating diplomatic relations with Solomon Islands after the Pacific nation decided to change allegiances and recognise China. The decision's a blow for Taiwan, as the South Pacific has long been considered a stronghold in its diplomatic battle with China, as our correspondent Natalie Whiting explains.
It wasn't her government's decision, but it was Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen who fronted the press. Taiwan says it's lost another ally. For weeks, the Solomon Islands has been investigating switching diplomatic ties from Taiwan to China. Last night, its cabinet met to vote, and afterwards, Taiwan released a scathing statement.
The cabinet of Solomon Islands government reached a decision to switch diplomatic relations to the People's Republic of China. The government of the Republic of China, Taiwan, finds this decision extremely regrettable and strongly condemns it. The government hereby declares the termination of diplomatic relations with Solomon Islands with immediate effect.
The Solomon Islands government hasn't made any statement on what happened in last night's meeting. The ABC has contacted several key ministers but is yet to receive any comment.
This is very much the end of an era.
James Batley is a researcher at the Australian National University and a former Australian High Commissioner to the Solomon Islands. He says the decision isn't a surprise given the Solomon Islands' lengthy investigation. It formed a task force which toured Pacific countries which were aligned with China and delivered a report last week which recommended siding with Beijing.
So I don't think any of Solomon Islands' neighbours, and that includes Australia, will really be surprised by this decision.
In addition to aid and infrastructure, many Pacific Island countries feel a relationship with China gives them diplomatic leverage with traditional partners like Australia in the current geopolitical climate. But in its statement, Taiwan suggested other factors were at play.
The government of China has once again resorted to dollar diplomacy and false promises of large amounts of foreign assistance to buy off a small number of politicians, so as to ensure that the government of Solomon Islands adopted a resolution to terminate relations with Taiwan.
The Solomon Islands is the seventh nation to swap sides since 2016, but the first in the Pacific.
I don't necessarily think that Solomon Islands' move marks the beginning of a snowball effect, but there's no doubt that Solomon Islands, I think, is a big prize for China in this diplomatic battle between China and Taiwan in the Pacific.
And that's James Batley, an ANU researcher and former Australian High Commissioner to Solomon Islands, and Natalie Whiting with that report. Israel's longest-serving Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is fighting for his political survival today as the country votes in its second national election in a year. Mr. Netanyahu set voters back to the polls when he failed to form a coalition government after an election in April. As Middle East correspondent Eric Torchik reports, it's a campaign that's been called the nastiest on record.
Hurry Putin, hurry Trump, visit us in Jerusalem, says the upbeat campaign song for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. But the catchy Middle Eastern pop is quite different from his party's other ads, which tell voters that electing the main opposition party will bring Arab Israelis into the government. Would you vote for a prime minister who attended an event for Palestinian terrorists, the ad asks, misrepresenting a reconciliation ceremony attended by former Army Chief of Staff Benny Gantz, the leader of the opposition Blue and White Coalition? Benjamin Netanyahu's relied on a racially based scare campaign, warning against leftists and Arab citizens of Israel conspiring to end the right wing's decade-long dominance. He's also promised to annex the Jordan Valley, part of the Palestinian territories under Israeli military occupation, and Jewish settlements in other parts of the West Bank. Mr. Netanyahu shrugged off criticism of his approach, saying the election is a referendum on his leadership.
The question in this election is a simple one. Who is going to be the next Prime Minister of Israel?
The election was ostensibly triggered by a bust-up between right-wing parties. A secular nationalist party refused to sit with ultra-Orthodox Jewish parties because of a disagreement about Israel's mandatory military service obligations. The divide between religious and secular Jews looked like it might become a major issue for voters. But political commentator Shmuel Rosner says the rerun of the election is ultimately about Mr. Netanyahu.
This is not right versus left issue. This is not about the Palestinians or Iran or the economy or corruption. It's about this one person and whether we want him to continue as Israel's prime minister.
Benjamin Netanyahu will face court next month on corruption charges. His opponents have run a campaign accusing him of undermining Israel's democracy during his many years in power. they're unlikely to get enough votes to form government themselves. But the co-leader of the Blue and White Coalition, Yair Lapid, told the I-24 news channel they will not form a unity government that includes Mr. Netanyahu.
No, we're not going to sit with him in the government because he had three indictments, very tough, hard indictments, and he needs to go and deal with his issues. And besides, being in office for 13 years, it's just too long.
That means yet more uncertainty for Israelis, who've had a caretaker government since January. From Jerusalem, this is Eric Twarczyk, reporting for AM.
A high-profile motor neurone disease patient's reached a settlement with a global cruise company after it turned him away from a trip he'd been planning for months. It's been described as a wake-up call for Australia's tourism and hospitality industry. Gavin Coote prepared this report.
It's billed as the expedition of a lifetime. But Justin Yerbury's plan for a holiday cruise hit an unexpected barrier earlier this year when the molecular biologist who has motor neurone disease was stopped from boarding a Royal Caribbean ship in Sydney. His wife Rachel says it was a huge surprise.
At the last minute, as we were going to board, and that was eight family members and two carers, we were denied access onto the Explorer of the Seas because we were told that we hadn't provided the medical information, which we had, but it hadn't been communicated to the ship.
The company apologised and fully refunded the Yerbury family for its expenses, but the scientist took legal action. He's now reached a settlement, with the cruise company promising to make its medical assessment process more transparent and to provide a single point of contact for guests with complex needs. Justin Yerbury, who communicates through a computerised voice, is pleased with the outcome.
I took action as a last resort to ensure no one else would have to go through the same disappointing and degrading experience.
This is a wake-up call for the tourism and hospitality sector. There's no question about that.
Graeme Innes is a former Disability Discrimination Commissioner. He too has taken legal action against big companies like Commonwealth Bank and RailCorp in New South Wales for discriminating against people with disabilities.
Cruise companies are coming to the realisation that it's foolish to exclude 20% of the Australian market.
Under the Disability Discrimination Act, it's illegal for a company to refuse to provide goods or services to a person with a disability. In the 2017-18 financial year, the Australian Human Rights Commission received 390 of these complaints. Karen O'Connell is an expert in discrimination law with the University of Technology, Sydney. She says Justin Yerbury should never have been turned away from his cruise, but admits the laws around what access businesses should provide aren't clear-cut.
So if you have a small business without a lot of resources, they shouldn't have to bankrupt themselves, you know, in order to make adjustments. And then if you're a bigger business and you've got a lot of resources and a lot of capacity, more is expected of you. But it also makes it more difficult to say exactly what is required.
That's discrimination law expert Karen O'Connell ending Gavin Coote's report. Workplace health experts are warning the deadly lung disease, silicosis, is significantly more widespread than first thought. 260 tradespeople have been working with engineered stone benchtops are being diagnosed with the disease and two have died. But there's concern silicosis is being overlooked in other construction industries, as Annie Guest reports.
At its latest meeting, the National Task Force Tackling Australia's Worsening Occupational Lung Disease, Silicosis, discussed setting up health registers, tracking imports, and commissioning more research into the problem. The Chief Medical Officer, Professor Brendan Murphy, chaired that meeting.
We made very good progress. We also talked about making sure that every state and territory in Australia has the same rigorous level of workplace safety and screening of affected workers.
They're screening tradespeople who've been working with engineered stone products, like kitchen benches, for lung disease caused by dust-containing crystalline silica, which is found in sand, stone, concrete and mortar. Figures provided by each state and territory to the ABC's 7:30 program show there are now 260 stone benchtop workers who've been diagnosed with silicosis. And that could be just the tip of the iceberg. Workplace health expert Kate Cole believes there's a high prevalence of silicosis in the building, demolition, quarrying and tunnelling industries.
Working in the construction sector for the past two decades or so, I know many men who have told me many stories of their personal struggle and their personal heartache of what it's like to live with silicosis. This is a thing that is real. It is not made up.
The Chief Medical Officer, Professor Brendan Murphy, says the task force is trying to grapple with the scale of the problem.
A disease register that we are considering would very likely cover all silica-related disease. What we haven't yet worked out is how feasible it is to screen those other workplaces where the actual risk of silica dust disease is much lower than the engineered stone industry. The engineered stone industry is the place where we've seen this explosion of accelerated silicosis.
But Kate Cole doesn't think that's good enough.
As an occupational hygienist, it's relatively common to measure silica dust over our current legal limits generally across those industries. So the prevalence would be high.
In your Churchill Fellowship report, you noted that it is possible for some to believe that collecting very few measurements on select good days is sufficient. So is that sort of willful cheating?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's willful cheating all the way through our industry, but I will say that there has been situations where that has been observed in some areas of our industry. So without specific laws that mandate certain control measures, these things will continue to happen.
It's occupational hygienist Kate Cole ending that report from Annie Guest. It's only a few months now until Australia's summer festival season kicks off, and with it the continued debate around pill testing. A New South Wales coroner is currently investigating a series of drug deaths, and many politicians remain staunchly opposed. But could a method used in the UK help break our political deadlock on drug testing? Tom Tilley reports from the UK festival Boomtown Fair.
In the English countryside, southwest of London, the summer festival season's in full swing. Well away from the main stages of Boomtown Fair, there's a wheelie bin full of drugs, bags and bags of pills and powders, and the intense smell of cannabis. All of these drugs have either been confiscated by security at the gate or voluntarily put in amnesty bins by festival goers. Then, in a demountable building deep inside the police compound, these substances are analysed at Boomtown Fair's back-of-house drug testing service. It's run by Trevor Shine, the director of Tic Tac, a private drug testing company.
Trevor, we've got another sample here. What is it?
It looks as if it's crystal MDMA, and we're going to run that on an infrared spectrometer.
It's a different model of pill testing from the one trialled at Groove in the Moo, Canberra, for the last 2 years. That service allowed people to walk in and get their drugs tested, then they'd receive professional advice and counselling. Other states and territories have balked at following the ACT's lead, arguing it gives a green light to drug use. The back-of-house model avoids that dilemma, yet Trevor Shine says it still offers some of the safety benefits.
If an ecstasy tablet was picked up and there was PMMA in it, which is pretty lethal, you might be able to say we've saved someone's life.
Throughout the 5 days of Boomtown Fair, Tic Tac identified two deadly substances. Boomtown organisers then alerted welfare and medical teams and spread the message to festival goers via posters, social media and the festival's mobile app.
Within an hour of putting out our alert about the yellow Superman pills, people were coming into the Loop service and they were disposing of those pills with us.
Fiona Meesham's the UK's best known pill testing advocate. She founded a service called The Loop. She was on site at Boomtown offering counselling and got some heartening feedback about the alerts.
Those pills that were handed in, that's the difference between people having a good time at the festival or having an absolutely terrible time in the medics.
This type of back-of-house service also operates at other big UK festivals, including Glastonbury, Leeds and Reading. In March last year, it was recommended by a Victorian parliamentary committee. So far, it hasn't been adopted.
Tom Tilley reporting there, and you can see more on that story on Foreign Correspondent, 8 o'clock tonight on ABC TV or on iView. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
There's this prison in Iran, Evin Prison. It's one of the most notorious in the world, and there's three Australians in it.
Evin Prison is secretive, brutal, and known for its human rights abuses. In today's episode, we hear an honest, close-up account from someone who spent 544 days there about life inside and the best chance for release.
That's The Signal. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.